This is the Boundless Pursuit Podcast, a show highlighting the purity of the experience without limitation. Each week, we'll bring anglers as diverse as the fish they chase, whether it be from your backyard or your bucket list. Freshwater, saltwater, conventional gear, or fly, we're bringing stories and perspectives from fishermen from all walks of life, from across the country and globe. In the digital age, authentic communication and networking is critical, and I'd love to hear from you about show suggestions, potential guests, or general feedback. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com or at my website, www.boundless-pursuit.com. That's where you'll find the entire collection of written articles, podcast episodes, and media. I deeply value the feedback, ratings, reviews, and support of my listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm your host, David Graham. Now let's get on to today's episode. Okay, I'm going to try to do my due diligence in this chronicle of the trip to Suriname. And as it stands now, I'm actually packed up and prepping for another trip, as I'll actually be flying out in just a few days to Spain, and I'll be out there chasing the Wells catfish, which is a longtime interest of mine, and potentially what could potentially be my sixth species of freshwater fish over 100 pounds if all goes to plan. But man, I'm just going to cut straight to the point in this podcast. I will go as far as to say that this trip to Suriname was the hardest trip that I've done. Or it's definitely up there. But to navigate that point, it wasn't physically difficult. And I need to establish that early. This wasn't like a physically taxing and difficult trip. But this was just one of those trips that tests your emotions and your nerves and your resolve, all while not actually exerting much energy at all. I feel like sometimes those are the hardest trips. It was just this inanimate process of sitting and sitting and sitting and just enduring uncertainty. I don't know, like physically, I feel conditioned. Physically, I can handle a grind of long walks, climbing, running, making 10,000 casts. But when you're just sitting and twiddling your thumbs and dealing with sheer uncertainty, that is not an easy thing to do. Fighting off internal doubt, pessimism, and negativity, like just both within your mind and the projected frustrations of the people around you. You don't even necessarily have to be dealing with difficulties of your own, but sometimes when the people around you are starting to project their concerns or their frustrations, it's just a compilation of all those things. It compounds what's an already difficult situation. And all these things are happening while you're basically just sitting on your ass. But anyway, to stay chronological here, the last trip to the Amazon in Guyana, September of 2023, I took that trip with my older brother, Matt. But this time, I traveled with my oldest brother, Travis. And it was just awesome to be able to share these experiences with them. And reflecting back on all those years stomping through local creeks, golf course ponds, and into like the early years of adventure for alligator gar, Travis was usually my main partner in those days. But I'll say the challenges for this trip, I mean, they started from the first step that we made out the door. We ran into issues immediately at the airport with our entry visas. Now, this whole process is kind of new to me. And the whole thing just frankly like pissed me off. I filled out the documents. I paid for my visa. But the document, like the voucher that I needed to get onto the plane, it simply never showed up. Did not come to my email. It just flat out vanished. And foolishly, I guess on my end, I figured that I could just sort it out at the airport, like show proof of confirmation of purchase, confirmation codes, etc. But they were not having it. And the people behind the desk, they're just completely and utterly useless and unhelpful. They sent us like nearly to the other side of the airport, claiming that there was a computer that we could use to fill out the documentation again. And of course, we get all the way there, and what do you know, there's no computer. So then we'd walk all the way back, let them know that we didn't find it, and they just continue to send us on this wild goose chase all over the freaking airport. And so we're sitting here trying to fill this document out on like the phone version of the website. I can just pick up my smartphone and get on the same website, but I don't know. There was some kind of issue with the phone app, the phone site. It wasn't functional. There was like portions of the website and hyperlinks that we needed to click that were not interfaced into the phone. It just, we needed a computer. So finally, I just called my wife. And now my wife is a freaking shark. Like the people that know her know she is a pit bull with chasing down leads and just getting shit done. But she is and always has been one of those people that just gets things done. And I kind of feel a little bit bad needing her to hunt down the process on our behalf, but she's just pure efficiency in everything that she does. And she came through clutch for us with only minutes to spare. And I guess I should say our original flight was at like, I don't remember, like 6 a.m. It was an early flight. If there's any silver lining to the way that the airliner handled things, we did have a big delay in our flight. And had we not had that delay in our flight, we wouldn't have had the buffer of time we needed to get all this stuff reorganized and restructured. So I guess that's the one good thing about having a flight delay. So anyway, she managed to get it done. We got the vouchers that we needed and we got through to customs. It was pretty cool though. Like side note, I've been like this huge MMA fan for a long, long time. I don't know how to pronounce the guy's name, but Jairzinho Rozenstruik, I think is how you say it. That guy was right in front of us in line, so that was pretty neat. Probably no one else listening knows who that is, but he's a heavyweight fighter in the UFC, and he actually lives in Guyana. So anyway, that was like my airport celebrity moment, if you want to give him celebrity status. But anyway, once we got boarded, the flights went pretty well. Suriname Airways, you know, say what you will about them. They don't necessarily have the best reviews, but to their credit, they have pretty comfortable seating and leg space. Even for the economy class bums like myself, who like to travel super cheap. But we got landed in Suriname, where Gary DeBoer was waiting for us. Now, Gary is the son of Paul DeBoer, who has run these fishing trips and ecotourism in Suriname for a long, long time. Now, I can assure you that pretty much any fishing trip that you will ever see of somebody going to Suriname, to the Quarantine River, to the Kapanam River, chasing giant Paraiba catfish, one of the DeBoers probably had their hand in that process. There's some level of involvement there. But we loaded all our gear up and jammed it into Gary's truck. And at this point, myself, my brother, and a longtime connection of mine named Jason Kentner packed into his truck together. Now, Jason's a longtime catfisherman, a competitive catfisherman, and a former guide. So I thought the idea of him putting like his U.S.-based catfish tactics and knowledge to the test against the Amazon's king would be cool. But anyway, we taxied about an hour and a half to our hotel for the night and just got rested up. And in the morning, that's where we met the other parties for the trip. Yuri Grizendi of Italy and Natakorn Shangru of Thailand, or Thumb as we call him. Thumb, I'm sorry if I butchered your name. Try my best, but we'll just call him Thumb for the purpose of this podcast. But again, apologize if I got your name totally slaughtered, Dumb. But anyway, many fishermen probably recognize Yuri. The guy's pretty much synonymous with giant whales, catfish. I mean, he's all over YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. I mean, he's amassed this enormous following, over 1 million followers easily. But Thumb is really on a similar wavelength in terms of social media stature. But Thumb's a good dude. This was a connection that I made in Guyana. I met Thumb in Guyana last September, and that's the beauty of these trips, is just connecting, meeting people, like tying lines, connections. But anywho, after our pleasantries, all of us got loaded up in the taxi buses, and we shuttled over to this small fishing village called Boss Camp. And that's about a two-hour ride or so, and at which point, all of us loaded up our respective gear into just this handful of boats. And we began heading up the Kapanam River, just progressively into fresher water and deeper jungle. Because Boss Camp is actually situated right at the mouth of the Kapanam, just right before it dumps out into the ocean. So a lot of saltwater influence there, mostly saltwater fish. So we're traveling further up river, and we're trying to get to those transitional points where it's becoming more and more fresh water. However, the river here is still tide affected. So that kind of added a different layer of challenge to this whole thing. But anyway, I mean, when we started traveling, the Amazon came out of the gates swinging. I mean, we didn't make it more than 2 miles upriver before this massive, just ominous wall of dark blue and gray climbed over the horizon. And we pretty much immediately knew that this was going to be a wet ride. I mean, the entire sky came down upon us, down upon this long aluminum boat. And the boat was just at absolute full weight capacity. I mean, we just crawled the entire ride, probably pushing the motor's limit on the weight that it can push. And what they said would be like a 2-hour boat ride turned into 2 hours more a few times. And it was just this long, long, long ride, maybe a 4-hour, almost 5-hour boat ride in torrential rain that seemed like it would never end. And the poor guy that was operating the boat, first of all, he's already got 6 full-grown men in it, loaded with all of our gear. And then the boat's just slowly filling with more weight in the form of rainwater. He's back there with a half of a milk jug that he cut in half, trying to bail and operate the boat in these white cap waves at the same time. It was just something. But it seemed like the proper introductory to the Amazon. It was like this christening, this welcoming, where the jungle's letting us know that y'all boys are in for it. But I think we all let out this like holler of relief when we turned the corner and saw our lodging on the horizon. The lodge or camp is a floating shack, essentially, constructed from forest wood, plywood, planks, sheet metal, tarps. They call it a houseboat. It's a really humble abode, I guess would be the right term for it. And the way the layout of this thing, anyway, it's you'd call it a pontoon, but it's just this, I don't know, 10 by 15 foot like platform of wood that's got these makeshift walls out of plywood and pillars and posts and a tarp strewn over the top of it to keep you from getting rained on. About as basic as you could possibly imagine. And they took a number of bunk beds and put them on the floor and a little toilet smack dab in the middle of that, which dumps straight into the river water below. I mean, it's as basic and fundamental as you can get. So, I mean, you know, we stepped aboard this thing and you pretty much realize we're all about to get to know each other very, very well. But we unloaded our gear. We all started getting rigged up almost immediately. Everybody's pulling out their gear, tying their rigs, and we just headed out for an evening session. So I guess I should establish or probably have said from the get-go, the trip's sole purpose, or I'll say the central purpose anyway, was around one species of fish, one key target, and that's the Piraiba catfish, locally known as the Lau Lau. It is the largest catfish on the planet, at least recognized on the record books by the IGFA, if I'm not mistaken. But it's arguably the largest catfish on Earth, period. I mean, there's debate there with Thailand's Mekong catfish, which has been documented at weights around 600 pounds. I mean, the Piraiba comes in respectably at about 400 pounds. But the Mekong is, you know, they've been so diminished in the wild that it's virtually extinct or basically impossible to catch outside of controlled and stocked pay ponds. But as far as like purely wild and established species, the Piraiba is the largest. And a 400-pound Piraiba, it's just astounding. Granted, that's exceptionally rare, but these fish are out there. And really on a global scale of just purely freshwater fish, all freshwater fish, it's in the conversation. Like it's in the topic of conversation for King. But anyway, I mean, it's just a spectacular fish. A very uniquely equipped animal. Not like the mostly fat, round, kind of sloppy-looking catfish that we have here in the States. Not to hate on our catfish. I love our catfish species, but these things are like these shovel-headed, streamlined, like hard-bodied fish with this dense, like rock-hard muscle. And they're just built for life in moving waters and just built for incredible power. And they've just got this unique look. I mean, I urge anybody to really do a deep dive into them. It's like they got this huge sail-like sickle-shaped dorsal. Like the dorsal opens up and fans out so big. It's very much like a shark dorsal. In fact, I think a lot of people call them or like refer to them as freshwater sharks. Like minus the teeth, obviously. But I mean, you take away the whiskers, you definitely see the parallels there in terms of their shape and their body structure. Anyway, though, the river itself, I had concerns almost immediately. I mean, near Boss Camp, hours downriver is, like I said, the mouth of the river where it dumps out into the ocean. It's tidal. It's salty. And the water's like in that whole area, even Guyana, on the coastal water is very murky, like literally like chocolate milk. And it's just not, it's not something you want to fish in. I really had hopes that as we traveled upriver, the color of the water would begin to transition, but it just didn't. It stayed the same consistent, like chocolatey brown stew of mud water, just absolutely zero visibility. And that to me was concerning. Like a lot of the times in most or many Amazon regions, people favor low waters. Like you want lower waters. You don't want to come around the rainy seasons or like when the river is up real high. But it's my understanding that in this situation, that's kind of reversed. Like in the Kapanam system, you want a consistent and powerful flow of fresh water in the rivers, like that which can only be provided by heavy seasonal rainfall. Because what it does is it pushes downriver and it holds that brown water back. It pushes it back. So heavier rains and heavier flows means more fresh water extending further downriver, keeping the muddy crap water at bay, if that makes sense. So like because of the lack of rain prior to our arrival, the brown stained water was able to push further and further and further upriver during the tide cycles and thereby push the bait fish and the catfish away with it. At least that was my hypothesis. So we found this challenge almost immediately because part of the daily routine was setting up these gill nets, like setting out bait traps. And we just weren't catching anything. I mean, yeah, the occasional small little squeaky catfish here and there, but like hours of effort, like hours of keeping these gill nets in the water during all tide cycles was just not yielding sufficient results. And in terms of Paraiba, like actually putting the baits in the water, nothing. Nothing that first session that evening, no bites, no activity. And really, so that pretty much started what was 8 days of some of the just roughest fishing I've ever dealt with. Just painstaking, sitting, waiting, and wondering. I think most people can probably do a 10-hour session. I mean, 10 hours of sitting, let's say just that's a one-off deal. You sit for 10 hours and get nothing. Most people can probably handle that, but day over day over day, it's brutal. But anyway, we're talking about the first day in Suriname, just waking up on the houseboat. We'll say the first full day where we began the day and ended the day there. We woke up on the houseboat and that was probably the most optimistic morning of the trip. I mean, everybody that got up was just in top shape. Everyone started the race kind of in the same position. But it was just a long, long day. That first day was just a long, drawn-out day of monsoon-level rain. Just absolute pounding rains. I'm guessing I think we showed up there at like the onset or the beginning of the rainy season. Like it was raining while we were there. I just don't think it was raining enough the months prior to our arrival. And the Amazon was speaking to us. I mean, the writing was on the wall. Like it was in the air. I've seen this. I've seen it enough times. Like you can sense it. You can smell it that things aren't going to come easy. And we spent hours upon hours that first day just enduring a mix of god-awful rain and then sunshine and just all factors of challenge that didn't involve fish, because we had no action, zero, not even the first nibble, not even piranhas pecking at our baits. There was nothing. I mean, it couldn't have been a more stark difference than my time in Guyana, where, I mean, we could have caught fish blindfolded. They're jumping out of the water, eating the baits before they even hit the water. So many fish. I mean, Guyana was the easiest freshwater fishing on planet Earth. And we come just one country away, a neighboring bordering country, and it's a just completely different scene at a completely different kind of river, though. It's just not a comparable thing. Not the same environment, not the same setup, just totally, totally different. But anyway, so we first fished that first half of the day and kind of regathered ourselves for lunch. That was sort of, you know, what we did each day at predictable hours. The routine was generally the same. And with these catfish, it's more or less a morning bite and an evening bite. In the middle of the day is the time that you put in trying to catch bait. Like, you're not really actively trying to catch the catfish as hard during high sun. But anyway, we talked over a short meal, like what the game plan was going to be. We, like, this is your moment to assess any changes that you might need to make. And I'll say, every day, like every moment, looking at that muddied water, it just left a festering like feeling in my core, this intuition. I think that's what it was. It was intuition. It's just not right. I don't know how to explain it, but at this stage in my time as an angler, I have long since learned to take those feelings as a call to action. Like, we need to get creative here. We need to start exploring. So we decided to hit like a smaller tributary, I think, on that second full day, a smaller tributary downriver that I'd been eyeballing, the Wyonbo River. So I kind of knew the general area of where we were going to be before the trip even began. A lot of like course plotting and planning and looking at Google Maps and thinking about what we're going to try took place before we even started. So I had pins on a map on this little Garmin inReach like satellite phone device that I had. I knew what we needed to do to game plan if things weren't going well or things that I wanted to try. But anyway, a little tributary that fed into the main Coppenham. So we headed a few miles up into the Wyonbo. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, for the purpose of this podcast, small tributary. But we did. We saw small but significant enough signs of life. Like, we were seeing things. I don't know how to put it. And it starts at the most minuscule level. A small flicker on the surface of a bait fish. More insects in the air. Like, you're looking at the big picture. Like, the all-encompassing. The very predators that would be diving down to even catch fish, whether that be an osprey or some kind of water birds, there was more of a prevalent abundance of life in this area that was indicative of more biodiversity. But as darkness kind of fell, so too did the tide begin to change. Our guide, this guy Winnell, who I just can't say enough about him, Winnell said that just after tide change, that's often the best bite window, just right after that tide shifts and changes. And that night, Travis ended up hooking into something that ran with god-awful intentions. I mean, we finally get picked up. We finally get action. And it didn't just slowly make off of it. This thing completely and utterly freight trained the line from the reel. Like, at no point allowing him to get the rod high or put the brakes on. It blistered out line before suddenly breaking it. The line just snaps. Just awful. Now, I don't know. I mean, you know, we can sit back and we can wonder, but I'm convinced that this was a self-inflicted wound. Yeah, a bad knot. A weak spot in the line that I had failed to notice. Something that I had done wrong. Like, this was human error, and we had to let it haunt us. But we also had to let it teach us. That is key. The worst thing we could do was let that, I don't know, bury itself into the back of our mind and just wreck us emotionally, to sit around pouting and getting pissed off and just letting it beat down on us. That will completely derail you and throw you off your game. So we had to let it teach us. So anyway, shortly after getting back on anchor, because when these things pull, you have to get off anchor and chase them. But we got back on anchor and we set the lines, and maybe 15 minutes later, Travis was on again on a hard charging fish. Now, I've never caught a piraiba myself. My other brother, Matt, actually caught one in Guyana. I couldn't believe how hard that it fought for a fish that was only around, I don't know, 60 or 70 or so pounds. And so I just, you know, I couldn't tell what Travis was contending with. The only thing that I could tell was that it was absolutely whooping his ass, like it towing the boat, throwing hellfire our way. But ultimately, we got the fish to the surface. And while it was a respectable fish, like it was the target species, it wasn't like the triple digit monster that we came for. But still, we are on the board. Like, we had made our first step in potentially getting a pattern down. And we sort of at least made right what went wrong just, you know, 30 minutes prior to that. And now we got some momentum behind us. But again, with some hours to go, still some hours to go in the night, we set back up on the anchor, same spot, and maybe like 15, 20 minutes passed before the line started peeling out of my reel. Now, we ran the same gear that I used in Guyana. I guess this is a good point to bring up, like, what kind of gear were we using? Some people want to know that. It was the same exact gear that I used in Guyana. I don't go fancy with it. Like, I use the same thing that has worked for me. I'm not there to break rods and or to look pretty. It was a 7-foot heavy, ugly stick boat rod paired with these 10 Spinfisher 8500 live liner reels that I've had for like over a decade. And they're spooled with 150-pound braid. Like, it's enough. I have faith in this simple setup for any freshwater fish, basically on Earth. Like, a combo like that is really all you need. But anyway, my fish, it charged hard. Like, it pulled hard, but it didn't seem as keen on covering ground like Travis's fish. Like, my fish chose instead to play heavy, like just long, sustained, heavy pressure towards the bottom. Like, it was a fight where I could tell the fish was very intentional in its movements. Like, it wasn't just randomly meandering about. I could feel that this fish knew where it wanted to go. And it was specifically just like trying to go to certain areas of the river. And now, to me, and the experience that I have with larger freshwater fish, that is the telltale sign of an older, more wily fish. Like, this is a fish that knows its territory. It's been around, and it was looking to take me into the abundant timber and snags that were on the bottom. And being that we were off the larger main river and up a more like narrow tributary, it didn't have to go that far to find snags. I mean, this is a close quarter scenario with a very powerful animal. And our fantastic guide, Winnell, like, this guy was cunning. He moved like very tactical in the movements of the boats, and he moved quickly just to get the boat positioned like directly over the fish so that we could keep the line vertical, because that's going to allow me to keep the fish out of snags. And when it would run hard in any direction, left, right, forward, whatever, Winnell was always quickly positioning the boat between the fish and any potential cover. So if this fish started heading towards the left bank, Winnell would quickly get on the motor and put us between the bank and the fish, corralling, shepherding, like herding the fish and keeping it flustered. So the fight went on for, you know, a decent little bit. And finally, the fish broke surface and we saw that it was a bigger specimen, like scarred and busted up, this gnarly looking animal. And something about this murkier water, like their flesh fades into this ghostly, like pale color. And it like reveals a lifetime of battle scars that tell stories that we couldn't imagine. Like, these fish are warriors. But we got the quality size fish to the boat and we towed it to shore. Like, this one's not coming in the boat. Not something you want knocking around at your feet. This is a quality size fish. A nice one, probably in the territory of 100 pounds or so. Very dense, solid, solid fish. Like, there's no part of their body you can really press on and like compress. But we got our photos, we got our fish, and now, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I've always kind of been a one fish guy. Like, I'm very target based when it comes to species. You know, I've still got days to fish, but at this point, I'm like, I can settle on this. I've done what I came here to do. And if we catch no other fish from here on out, I can live with that. You know, there was no other action that night. So regardless, we headed back to camp very motivated. We had an idea of what we needed to do to catch fish. But that night, and really every night thereafter, I just knew that I needed to do it. I would spend time just walking in the forest. It's just a good opportunity to just get out there, like immerse myself in the jungle, not become so singularly focused on the fish that I miss out on everything else that's out there in the jungle. So I was just walking out there every night, hoping to find some kind of creature. Like, before I was a fisherman, I was that kid obsessed with wildlife, with snakes and reptiles and animals. And I mean, we just spent so many years looking at books of the Amazon. So I'm out there looking for snakes, big insects, just anything. And that was fun. We did it every night. I mean, we found scorpions, all kinds of these crazy, colorful, giant spiders. A handful of like tree-dwelling snakes and things like that. But I will say that we didn't see anything that was like too crazy out of the ordinary. I think maybe I just don't have the eyes for it. There's no telling what kind of animals I walked past and missed. So we went to sleep that night, but the guides kept busy. Like, they would go out at night and hunt And I think we woke up on like the third full night. I guess you could consider this the fourth day in Suriname, but the third full night. I don't know. My time got all thrown out of whack out there. That's what happens. You just lose track of time. I'm like, are we on the third day? Are we on the fifth day? I don't even know it. At some point, you just lose track and you stop caring. But in any sense, we woke up the next morning and they'd killed some kind of large rodent. Like, I think they called it a banana rat, like a 20-pound rat, basically. Or like, I don't know, it like what looked like a huge guinea pig kind of thing. And that's lunch. Like, we're eating it. Straight up bush meat. So that was exciting. That's sort of like, I don't know. It's like, it's part of the experience that you kind of want. And really, trust me, you get hungry enough out there that you don't care. But I don't know. I could hardly identify it because its head was missing because they blew its head straight off its shoulders. But anyway, I guess that was like our most unique jungle meal. And the taste really wasn't bad. I would actually, I'll be frank, I don't know if they jazzed it up a certain way, but wait, we ate that and some kind of jungle bird pheasant thing. And I could hardly tell the difference between the, you know, the poultry of sorts and this little jungle rat. And the meat was fine. It was good food. But anyway, going into the next day, I'll say despite our fortunes the night before where we had actually caught the fish, we again spent the entire day just getting absolutely no action, none whatsoever. We could hardly find bait. Our lines were just not getting touched at all. And the river conditions were not changing. We could just continue to get hammered by these isolated storms and then endure unimaginable humidity in its wake when the sun would poke through. So, you know, you're starting to realize we're doing the same thing here. We're not trying really anything different and nothing new is happening. So once again, I kind of urged us to move up river where the cleaner water might be. So I decided, you know what? Let's get with Winnell. Let's say, hey, let's try up river. So we headed like an hour further up river and the waters did seem to clean up just a bit. Like there was, I don't know, maybe a foot of visibility, whereas an hour downriver, it was straight up zero, not even a centimeter, no visibility. But up in this cleaner water, this marginally cleaner water, we found a tremendous amount of bait. Like we didn't find the piraiba, we didn't find the catfish, but you know, it's the thing with this is whether it's the Amazon or some river here in America, it's fishing 101, where you find the bait, you find the fish. I don't need to look for the cat. I don't need to look for the catfish. I don't need to look for one giant animal. I just need to look for a few small fish that it's eating. I mean, in any case, we're going into essentially 4 days of fishing where our group as a whole is simply not catching. Like nobody's catching anything or fish at the, or worse, they're hooking up and losing the fish. So I think it was around the fourth night. I don't know, the third full day's night. Around night four, you could kind of sense that temperaments were shifting. Maybe earlier than that. I'd say for some people, the second night, third night, definitely by the fourth night, things were starting to come to a head. I mean, you could sense temperament shifting, emotions waning. Pessimism had crept into camp. Like pessimism, it's just this dark shadow that overtakes the mindset. And being confined on this tiny floating houseboat, it's nearly inescapable proximity if the person beside you starts projecting their misery. And like to make matters worse, in the middle of the night, on one of these nights, in the middle of the night, I mean, the tide would shift and it would pull so hard. But one of those nights, the anchor to our houseboat failed. And I don't know, somebody woke up and realized that we had drifted miles away. Like that, you know, you could barely make out the silhouette of the tree line on the horizon, but it was not supposed to be moving. Like I hopped out of my bed, put on my glasses, looked out of the boat and I could see that the trees were slowly going past the boat. Like this is a problem because the guides aren't on the boat with us. We're just a bunch of guys from other countries on this little boat together and it's floating away into the jungle. So it's like kind of a scary feeling. Like you almost feel lost, but at the same time, it's one river. It's one way in, one way out. You know, we're going to get found if we get lost. But you know, I guess that was an adventurous moment of the trip. A little bit of anxiety. That certainly didn't help. I think prior even to the anchor failing, people were already getting moody. And then you throw in this anxiety that like, oh, we're going to be lost. Did not help. It actually, you know, I don't know. It resulted in some explosive moments on the boat, and things were not getting good. But anyway, the guides had to come searching for us and basically tie the small boats up to the houseboat and tow us back. So anyway, that most certainly didn't help the paranoia and like negative energy that was abounding in camp at this point. But the next morning, in the wake of some of the in-camp drama, we just decided to remain on base and like close to camp for the day. Just get a bit of a day of rest, reassess, come up with a game plan. Just stop, pause, and be smart with our next moves. So that morning, I approached our guide and I approached the trip coordinator, Gary, with a plan. I wanted to head way up the Wyonbo River, the same river where we had caught the fish. Like, I want to go way up. I'm talking hours and hours upriver. But to do that, we needed gas. Like, we needed a lot of gas. We needed more gas than we had. So I had a hunch. Like, I had this hunch, but I knew that it would cost me. I guess that makes it a gamble because, you know, I'm paying for it. So I went to Gary and I pitched this idea and I said, listen, I'll give you however much amount of money is needed, which ended up being, I don't know, $170. Send a boat back into town, fill me up a bunch of gas tanks and supplies. Like, we laid out a game plan to make this long, long haul upriver in the morning of, I don't know, the fifth full day. So maybe the sixth day in Suriname, the fifth full day there. And so we did that. That day was a rest. We woke up the next morning. I guess it was the fifth day, I believe. Fifth out of 7 full days of fishing, something like that. But we woke up at like 4 in the morning and began our trek. Bunch of tanks of gas. And we headed up the Wyonbo River. So we went so far up that river, like far enough that to continue beyond, we needed to like stop at a local indigenous village and essentially ask for permission to go any further. Like, when you get that far up, you're in like indigenous territory. And so we pulled up at this little town. I cannot remember the name of it. Village, not town. But our guides got out. And I don't know. I got this sense that like we, you know, you get the sense that we're not supposed to follow them into the village. We're told that like the guides basically needed to ask the village captain. They called him the village captain. I guess like it's like the equivalent of the chief. In charge, like the chief in charge, and we needed to ask for permission to go further up the river. So after like, I don't know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes of deliberation, we were basically told that we could continue on. But it was cool being there. It was just like, it's always neat to see these villages. It's like this neat glimpse into a different way of life. Like, we don't get to see that really here in America. You don't get opportunities to, I don't know. It just gives you perspectives to see how other people live and then realize how you live, if that makes sense. But in any case, it was like this change of scenery that I think we needed. Like in the days leading up to that point, I mean, I was loving, don't get me wrong, I was loving the atmosphere of the lower Kapanam River, but something about that trek up the Wyonbo, like it like the river began to creep in around you. It got like tighter. The water got clear. The like green towering walls of forest closed in more and more as we went upriver. And there's just more signs of life. There's more birds. We saw caimans, just animals, just things felt right. Like the same way that my gut instinct was telling me that the main river where camp was wasn't going to pan out. I could just feel the fish here where we're going. Like, I jokingly told the people around camp that I can smell a big fish, like that good fortune has an aroma. And I knew when a big fish was near, and I could feel that here. Like, things were shifting. The village itself, like life in the village was so unique there. Just seeing folks paddling by on handcrafted dugout canoes, canoes made entirely from a single log. Like these tiki huts and structures that are made from logs and sticks and palm fronds. There's like this mix, just like in Guyana, like this mix of indigenous architecture, craftsmanship, and ways of living right alongside more modern things. So like, it was interesting. Like some of the dugout canoes, like old canoes that have probably been generational, you know, architecture that have outboard motors on them. like the people operating them and walking into and out of the humble houses had Nikes on. Like they had electricity. They had means of power. But I think the most impressive thing that we saw, like the most impressive structure, was what was built on the river itself. In order to pass up the river meant going through this massive steel structure. Like, I don't know, some kind of engineering authority must have like placed it there. Like, it was like more like a system of locks, like this enormous metal gate system. Like, it wasn't a hydraulic thing. It was like this giant sliding steel door that had to be hand cranked open. Like, it took like three men to turn this wheel and cable winch this thing open enough just to get our boat to pass through. Like, unless this gate is open, you can't go any further. Like, the river's off limits. You're not getting past it. But I mean, I've been through some stuff. Like, I've never been through some stuff like this. And I don't know. I just kind of chuckled under my breath. Like, I'm aware enough in the moment to realize I've gotten myself really far from home, all in the name of catching a fish. It's just crazy. And so I'm like sitting here and have this moment of awareness. Like, look where you've gotten yourself. Like, look how far from home you are just to catch this fish, to have this moment. And that's just where we are. I don't know. This is soul speaking stuff. But anyway, we headed along like to an area where there's like these swamps along the margins of this small little river that we're in. Like in these marginal swamps, they're spilling over in areas. There's like these little creek outflows, this dark, like dark tannic water, like dark ink black water. Like, it's still crystal clear, but it's black. Like, it's like Pepsi and it's running off. And like where it was mixing into the main river, there's like this, I don't know, there's some sort of effect there that for whatever reason, it attracted these huge congregations like and gatherings of electric eels. I mean, these things are everywhere, like piled in the confluence of like swamp water and main river. And it was weird. Like, you'd see them bob up to the surface and take a gulp. I guess they just gulp surface air. And then they'd slide backwards in reverse into the depths. Prior to this trip, I'd been stating for months and months that the electric eel was one of my absolute top priorities for this trip. And I really think a lot of folks that I expressed that to thought it was like a bit of a joke. But I'm dead serious on this. Like, I really wanted an electric eel on rod and reel. Like, almost as much as I wanted the Piraiba catfish itself, the electric eel was like right there. Like, this is a fish I really, really wanted to experience. So we got to this spot and we see all these eels. So we posted up there and fished. Like, I want to catch one. And the crazy thing, these eels are, they're really weird. Like, they have zero fear. It's one of the strangest fish I've ever seen, just behaviorally. It was just bizarre. I was like, there's no awareness at all that like we zipped in on top of them. Like, they were sitting right on top of them. No reaction, no fear. But like, even stranger is their absolute willingness to bite. Like, even a bear hook, like a bear hook, they'll just eat it. Like, without any thought process. So like, even like throwing a metal lure and just letting it lie on the bottom. Like, you didn't have to move the lure. They're just biting it. It was just bizarre. So I pulled out the smallest little lure that I have. They have kind of like a real weird small little mouth. And so I pulled out this little inline spinner and I just cast it out and basically just left it still. Didn't have to move it. Didn't have to jig it. You just cast it out and like leave it there. And over and over and over, they'd bite. 100%. What's really, I don't know, it's just a weird fight too. Like, they weren't taking out line or really fighting much at all. It's like, generally, they just sort of like, it's like they were trying to pull in reverse. Like, they're trying to back away from what had grabbed them. A lot, and there were so many eels, like, we would catch them in the mouth. And because they were so thick in the water, some of them, we were just snagging them. They'd just get, like, they'd swim by and get stuck on the lure. So it's like they're either fighting in reverse if they're hooked in the mouth, or they would like spiral like a tornado and just get helplessly twisted up in the line if we like snag them. But still, I was just excited and prepared. Like, I wanted to catch these. Like, going into this trip, I knew I wanted to catch electric eels. I knew that they were there. So I came prepared, like so much so that I actually bought this pair of these like thick rubber lineman's gloves or like electrician's gloves, like these big solid rubber gloves rated for like 20,000 volts. And at best, an electric eel might be able to generate like 700 or 800 volts. Like, so there's no way they're going to hurt me if I'm wearing these gloves, but I'll say I was still nervous to try them, but it was pretty funny. You know, I hooked the first fish, brought it to the boat, and there's actually like a local villager that was camping out alongside where all these eels were. And I'd say between him and our guides, like you could really tell that they were eager to see the idiot American get shocked. Like they were very interested in watching what was going to happen next. Like, I don't think that they believe that the gloves would do anything like to stop from getting blasted by one of these things. So when I reached down and snatched up the first eel, like I snatched it up and I held it up triumphantly over my head. And I don't know, there's probably a lot of confusion around. You could tell that they couldn't believe what the heck was going on. But anyway, it was cool. We stayed there for a little bit and we caught numerous electric eels. Even Thumb. So I should mention, Thumb had actually come as well, all the way upriver. They told us we couldn't go with one boat. That we, like, you had to bring two boats, just mostly in the event that there was some kind of mechanical failure, you'd have somebody there to save you. So, but anyway, Thumb came. He also caught his fair share, and we kept a few of them for bait, and we even kept a few of them to eat. Now, I was told that electric eels are not good Piraiba bait. I don't know how often people try. All I know is that I look at this thing and it's 5 feet long. It's almost as big around as your leg or your arm at least. So like you look at this 5 foot long strip of fish meat and that thing can be chunked out as days worth of bait. Like one eel can provide a lot of bait. And as far as I'm concerned, like realistically, when they're not actively pulsing an electric charge, it's just a fish. It's still oily flesh, blood, meat, guts. Something will eat them. I refuse to believe nothing's going to eat an electric eel. So we caught several of them. And then we went to go try to catch peacock bass. Now, I'm not here for peacock bass. I don't care about peacock bass. Like the peacock, at least the peacock bass in this region, like the ones that are in this area, they're just, you know, really small butterfly peacock bass, like basically the same thing as I have in Florida. Now, I mean, if these would have been those big 20-pound Tamensis 3-bar peacocks, sure, I'd have probably burned the whole trip trying to catch one of those, but I just don't care about little peacock bass. So I don't know. I probably made 5 casts before I was like, you know what? I said, I don't care about peacock bass. We need to maximize our time soaking baits. And I have faith in these electric eels. So we set up on this area where this, like the river we're in, it like branched off in like 3 directions. Like this, it's this nice confluence. Now, this is where the deepest water will be. Like this convergence or intersection from different arms of river. It like everybody knows if you fished any rivers, like this is the area that bores out holes. Like this is where the deep water is going to be. It's also going to be like the depository for all timber and snags and debris that flows down each of those rivers. And it's going to settle there on bottom. Like it's the ideal spot for a large fish to be. This is about reading a river, like reading a river, knowing what works. And so, you know, it's river fishing 101, basic fundamental reading of a river. So we set up, as you should do, tactically and strategically, we set up at the head of the hole, meaning like up current, where like the oils and the body scent of the baits are going to blow into that hole and draw any potential catfish out of it, searching for it. You want to create like a scent slick that's going to blow downstream into that deep hole where presumably the bigger fish are living. So we did that. We set up our eel chunks and no lie, it wasn't 10 minutes before a line started slowly buzzing out and Travis had a run. This blew my mind. I mean, we had gone 5 days prior to this of sitting on baits for hours and hours and hours and hours. And here we are on a hunch, trusting instincts, going where we thought would work. And we get a run in 10 minutes on the bait that nobody thought worked. it's just craziness. But anywho, we let the fish carry it for a little bit. Just let it eat. Because we want to seal the deal on this fish. We want to let it eat. We need to make sure that we're going to get good hook penetration. And anyway, we did that. And Travis came tight on the fish, set hooks on it. And very similar to the fight of my larger fish, his didn't fire off on a blistering run. It just kind of maintained this ominous, eerie, slow, but intentional digging pace. Like, this fish was big and we knew it. There's just like these slow, like watching the rod arc over. There's these slow, eerily slow, like pulsing bends in the rod, like where it rises slow and it drops slow. It rises slow and it drops slow. Just these movements that are indicative of huge tails swathing back and forth. Like, you can almost measure the size of a fish by how long it takes the rise and drop of the rod as a fish pushes its massive tail back and forth. So we knew this thing was big. There's no questioning. It's just a matter of how big of a fish are we dealing with here. But anyway, Travis stayed tight, maintained pressure. Like, the previous fish that we had caught, like, these were good practice rounds, but now we're dialed in. And frankly, this is our shot. Like, this may be it. So we stayed vertical, followed the protocol, and ultimately, this enormous head broke the surface. And oh my Lord, we all started screaming. Even Winnell. I mean, we're going crazy, but like, we don't have it yet. Like, this thing's got the power to make one tail swipe, break the line, throw the hook, do something chaotic. But Winnell bent down and he secured the fish. He had like this tool or this like device that he made. It was basically just a rope that had two big circle hooks on it. And it's like essentially a tow rope. So he bent down and he popped these two big circle hooks into the corner of the fish's mouth, and we had him pinned. And at this point, again, we're towing the fish. It's too big, way too big. I mean, double the size of the one that I'd caught. But we towed the monstrous fish to shore, and we got into the shallow water where we could contain it. And basically, we had it. I mean, we won. We got the fish. Just a spectacular animal. And I mean, it's just this. These are these crazy moments that I don't know. I can't describe it, but I've got the foresight to recognize when I'm in the moment, if that makes sense. Sometimes you don't realize the moment till after the fact, but I've always been very present when these things happen. I mean, you fish your whole life progressively, pushing further, graduating up, like leveling up. And as you become more and more experienced, like, sometimes that awe-inspiring feeling becomes fleeting, if that makes sense. Like, you know, as your experiences become greater and your fish become greater, it's a little bit harder to find those moments where you catch a fish and you feel a true sense of awe, like the ones that just freeze you. And don't get me wrong, like, I don't want to give the wrong message here. I still get the shaky hands and the trembling knees at a double digit bowfin, just like when I was a kid. But I'd be lying if I said that I still get that deep, just guttural, like, spiritual reaction out of a common game fish here in the U.S. Like, this fish that we hauled up was something truly special. It was the place. It was the environment. It was all of the absolute crap that we had dealt with just to get there and be present in that moment, holding the fish in our hands. It was a truly earned fish. And I think even deeper than that, I think about the days that, like, me and my brother Travis grew up in this whole thing. Like, Travis took me in my earliest adventures, sneaking under barbed wire fences into cow pasture creeks onto private property. Like, we would bring Travis and I in those earliest days, we'd bring nothing but a rod tip, like the top half of a two-piece rod. And we carry just that rod tip and tie like a strand of line to that top guide, like to the rod tip. It was almost like a little miniature cane pole. And we toss out like a single J hook with a piece of bologna on it and bury the rod half into the mud, you know, just toss it out, leave it there and go looking for frogs and snakes and turtles. And then we'd come back and find that that little rod tip would be bending and pulling, and we just pull in little bullheads and sunfish. Like, this is origin story. This is seeing things develop and evolve. Like, this is early stage to final stage stuff here. And so you have to stop and think about that. This wasn't a rapid progression for me. I'm not some guy who just started fishing and came upon this great wealth and went from 0 to 100. This is a proper progression from the most humble beginnings and graduating in levels from little bluegill and bullheads to golf course pond bass to moving up to my first carp and gar. And it went up and up and up over decades. And my brother was there when I wet my first line. Like, we went through it all. The days of chasing carp on golf courses and country clubs, to the early days of chasing alligator gar. And yet, here we are, the same two guys, in a completely and totally different country, some 25 to 30 years later, chasing one of the most coveted freshwater giants on the planet. Just insane. And I recognize these things, and I appreciate these things. And I think about margins. Like, I think about how marginal fishing is. Like, we conflate how much skill that we have. I think we do. I think fishermen like to conflate how much skill is involved. We like to ignore how much of fishing is simply chance and opportunity. I think that's what it is. It is chance and opportunity. Of course, there's skill. There's intuition. I think part of your skill building is your intuition. Your intuition grows. Your ability to read a situation, read a moment, reflect back on other times you've hit same proverbial crossroads and know what moves to make next. It's like chess playing. It's like playing chess, but it's simply chance and opportunity. I look at fishing that way. To me, it's about time. It's about hours. It's about decision-making, position. I say position physically being where you should be, but also positioning your mind and your temperament as well. That was a big one on this trip. And I think about, what if we hadn't had this strange hunch to go upriver? What if I didn't have this obsession to find an electric eel? Like, what if I had no interest in catching electric eels? What if I thought, nah, that's nonsense. I'm not here for that. What if we had stayed on these eels 5 minutes longer or 1 minute shorter? Or what if we had encountered a single peacock bass and dedicated an extra 15 minutes to casting to it? You factor in decisions like this and think about how it would have affected the placement of that chunk of eel crossing the path of that giant catfish's route just so perfectly as it made its way into that area at that precise moment. Had anything been out of place or been done differently, we may have never caught that thing. Not obviously just the same. Maybe we would have caught something bigger. But to me, that is the allure of fishing. That stuff that keeps you up, that keeps you sharp. Like, the things that keep you aware and in wonder. I mean, there was more trip to it after that giant fish, but that was our showcase moment. Like, that was our fish. Like, there were certainly a few other happenings in the final days of the trip, but nothing especially noteworthy, like, here and now for the purpose of the podcast. I think the key takeaway from the trip was the tone of difficulty, just like listening to instinct. I think that is the theme of this experience, was the difficulty in listening to instinct. My big observation here, my big takeaway was this. It was knowing the difference between being resolute and being stubborn. Like, that's a hard one to see, and only experience teaches it. I think a lot of guys will see a sign, will get a glimmer of hope. Maybe that's the rod tip bouncing, a single line getting pulled, or like a boil on the surface, like those little hints, those little signs. And I think a lot of people, when they see that, they get married to a spot, or they get married to an approach or to a pattern. And to them, they're being resolute. I'm being resolute. I'm seeing this through. And maybe that tactic will work. But I think that there has to be, with fishermen, there has to be an internal dialogue that takes place where you set a hard line and you tell yourself exactly how long you're willing to push before you realize you need to try a plan B. Do you even have a plan B? Did you have the foresight to plot courses ahead of time, mark maps, check areas. Consider what you'll do on this tide, that tide, rain, sun, morning, day, or night. And most importantly, how will you react when your plans are not working? This whole trip was all a giant opportunity to test ourselves. That, to me, is what these kinds of trips are. And really, every fishing trip is, at some level, some degree. It's a great opportunity to put lessons learned over the course of time on the water to the ultimate test. And for all the shit that went wrong on this trip, I take it all as a positive conditioning that will only make me tougher for trips coming in the future. But anyway, that's it. That's a wrap. That's the trip. That is the Suriname Chronicle. I want to say I appreciate those of you who listened, if you stayed and listened to the whole thing, those who followed any and all of my catches. If you're listening now, I'm actually leaving on Monday, April 8th. I'm actually leaving on my next trip for the next giant fish, a trip to Spain where I'm looking to tackle the Wells catfish. So, you know, follow along, keep up for updates on that. I'll probably do a similar recap after that trip. But once again, I appreciate you listening. I'll catch you on the next one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Boundless Pursuit. Tune in each week as we bring stories and insight from uniquely talented anglers and outdoorsmen. And if you enjoyed this show, I want to hear from you. Be sure to leave a 5-star review, as this is going to drive the growth and exposure of this show. And if you have feedback or guest suggestions, I would love to hear from you. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com. For all other collections of media and contact information, please visit www.boundless-pursuit.com.